for the judge, and we have to hold the judge accountable only after all of the proceedings are done. Those who are accused still have the right to defend themselves within the judiciary process, and they have to be treated equal to any Lebanese citizen, as the Constitution states, because the crime is a crime against humanity, and it is not something that is allowed for anyone in Lebanon, even if they held a big office.
Ms. Jamas, one of the reasons that Prime Minister Diab was refusing this probe is that he said that according to what happened, Judge Sawan is actually violating the Constitution by overstepping the role of the Lebanese Parliament, which has specialized courts for the trial of top officials. Yet, Judge Fadi Sawan had tried to get Parliament to explore the political responsibilities of those ministers, but the Parliament declined to move forward. Why did the Parliament decline this request?
The Parliament is defending itself. The Parliament is equal to those ministers and to the Prime Minister. They are equal party. They are representing the Parliament at the government. And therefore, the Parliament has something called the conflict of interest standard. In the American Anti-Corruption Institute, there are 10 principles of fighting corruption. And in those 10 principles, one of them is the good and effective governance. Under that, there is something called the conflict of interest. Now, those people who have been named or accused by the judge are all directly related to the parliament members, especially those overseeing the parliament. And therefore, they are in a position of self-defense, understood. Therefore, we should be ignoring all those remarks from the parliament, because their intervention in not allowing the judge to pursue the prosecution as should be is very big in terms of intervention and in terms of no governance and in terms of responsibility. There's something, a principle called authority and accountability. Those who have the authority have to be held accountable by someone, and it's the judiciary. This court that they are talking about should have been established in 1992, and it was ignored, and we are in 2020, going into 2021. That means they had no intentions of ever being held accountable for any of their actions. But at this time, I believe that it is very difficult to get away with such a crime, and they will be held accountable, and if they are accused, they are therefore defendants, and they have the right to defend themselves and to prove their innocence. So why are they arguing such innocence outside the prosecution process?
Well, it is a big issue where more than 200 people passed away because of the blast, and more than 6,000 were injured, and billions of dollars were lost in that damage to the capital. Yet Diab's government resigned just 2 days after the explosion, and since then, Saad Hariri has been named as prime minister designate, but he still has not managed to formulate a government despite the calamities in the country. What do you think will happen if the judge keeps pushing this investigation while Saad Hariri remains just stuck? What happens? How will the country function politically?
This is very important. The judge and the judiciary's process should be completely separate of what happens in politics. We do not accept politicizing the judge's decisions.
This is Lebanon, though. This is why it's a very important question. How do you think this will continue?
I understand completely what you are saying in terms of questioning, because they have taught the world that only politics is ruling in Lebanon. Mm-hmm. Now we are telling the people that the prevalence should be for the rule of law, and there should be accountability. And we would like this judge, or the judge that they appointed, this is not a judge appointed by the people, to continue the mission. Otherwise, the credibility of the whole judiciary is at stake, because it means that if we appoint a judge, he can only, you know, give the answer that we want. Otherwise, we will take him out and bring someone else or pressure him into resigning. This is very dangerous, and it means that Lebanon is absolutely crumbling. It is worse than the financial and the economic crumble.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ms. Shammas, you see, one of the issues that is being brought up in the Lebanese media is two of the ministers who are being charged with the crime were blacklisted by the United States of America and sanctioned for supposedly being allies of Hezbollah. What are the odds that this investigation is based on maybe U.S. demands as well, rather just on coincidence of these people being in office during the years where the ammonium nitrate was in the port of Beirut?
They don't have anything to worry about if they are innocents. I think they have enough money to be able to defend themselves. Mm-hmm. This investigation is demanded by Lebanese blood and the blood of many foreign citizens that fell dead because of this blast. Mm-hmm. It is demanded by the more than 6,000 people who are injured. It is demanded by the parents of the injured and of the deceased. It is demanded by the city and the country of Lebanon and the people of Lebanon, in Lebanon and outside Lebanon. It is the truth that we are seeking, and it is the truth that should prevail. And we should not be succumbing to the pressures of those who are talking whatever they would like to talk, simply to politicize the process, because they are defending themselves. Since they have been accused, everything they say falls under self-defense.
Well, it is
and,
obvious
and
that
in the wrong place.
Everyone keeps saying that in Lebanon, for a real revolution to happen, it should start at the judiciary system of Lebanon. I want to thank you very much, Ms. Gina Shammas, political commentator, for joining us to talk about how the Lebanese prime minister is now being investigated because of the huge blast of August 4th in Beirut port. Thank you for being with us. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran by a shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran by a shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa by a shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
U.S. congressional leaders announced on Sunday, December 20, that a deal between Democrats and Republicans had been reached to provide significant aid to Americans struggling with the financial impact of the coronavirus pandemic. But while the nearly $900 billion deal includes a direct stimulus payment to most Americans, many critics have lambasted the amount that was agreed upon. $600 as too little to help those who are struggling to pay rent, bills, or other debts during the crisis. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Chris Walker Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Critics Blast $600 Stimulus Checks That Won't Cover 1 Month Rent for Most Americans. Stay tuned, please. U.S. congressional leaders announced on Sunday, December 20th, that a deal between Democrats and Republicans had been reached to provide significant aid to Americans struggling with the financial impact of the coronavirus pandemic. But while the nearly $900 billion deal includes a direct stimulus payment to most Americans, many critics have lambasted the amount that was agreed upon. $600 is too little to help those who are struggling to pay rent, bills, or other debts during the crisis. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell announced on Twitter that the deal had been reached shortly after it was brokered. As the American people continue battling the coronavirus this holiday season, they will not be on their own, McConnell wrote. Congress has just reached an agreement. We will pass another rescue package as soon as possible. More help is on the way. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi also lauded the deal. We're going to crush the virus and put money in the pockets of American people, she said in a statement recently. The bill will include a number of provisions meant to help Americans and small businesses during these trying times. Unemployment insurance will be extended for 11 weeks, with an additional $300 added to the typical unemployment check, or about half of the additional funds that were part of a similar COVID relief package earlier this year. The bill also include $284 for payroll loans to businesses to help them continue paying workers, including $15 billion to leave venues, movie theaters, and other entertainment. Around $10 billion will be dedicated to child care assistance as well. But most of the provisions will not go directly to workers. The mentioned bill provides $15 billion to the airline industry, for example, with $2 billion going to airports. The bill also includes a tax deduction for corporate meal expenses that critics have dubbed the three-lunch tax cut, allowing corporate executives to write off on their taxes lunch expenses. The White House has suggested that this tax cut will help restaurants, but critics have said that it would do very little to actually provide aid to the struggling industry and would more likely pad the pockets of those who are not in need of help during the pandemic. Perhaps the most discussed aspect of the agreement is the direct payment of $600, which is planned to go to most American adults in the country earning under $75,000 per year for individuals, $150,000 for couples. Those who earn above that amount will receive stimulus payments that gradually lessen as they earn more, with individuals earning above $99,000 this past year, or $198,000 for couples receiving $0 in assistance. American families will also receive $600 for each dependent child in their home. While any amount of stimulus payment will provide some relief, critics contend the payments are too far and too small to help most Americans, noting that they won't even cover rent for most in the country. Although the said bill includes $25 billion in rental assistance, an analysis from Moody's Analytics this month found that Americans have collected close to $70 billion in rental debt as they enter the new year. That means for many Americans in dire need of such help that those $600 payments will likely go toward paying rent or mortgage payments. Unfortunately, $600 is far less than what most pay when it comes to renting a place to live. Indeed, according to research from Experian, no state in the U.S. has a median rental rate that is under $800. 41 states plus Washington, D.C. have median rental rates of $1,000 and above. $600 won't cover the rent or the bills that have piled up. Since the start of the debate for a new stimulus began, Georgia Democratic candidate for Senate John Ossoff tweeted upon news of the reel. We deserve better. Many Americans may share those sentiments, according to an unofficial Twitter poll that Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez tweeted last week. Only 5.3% who responded to the informal poll said that a $600 stimulus payment would be enough. Around 32% answered the poll by clicking no, while the remaining 62% in the survey responded with hell no.
The United States has spent the last two decades fighting an endless and unwinnable war in Afghanistan, with the conflict costing the US billions each year, as well as a loss of life on both sides, reminding us all of the embarrassing defeat suffered by the US in Vietnam. But with the US slowly outstaying its welcome in West and Central Asia, as demonstrated by the Iraqi parliament voting to oust them, it seems that Washington is intent on leaving a lasting legacy in the region, particularly in Afghanistan. A secret CIA-trained hit squad known as Zero One has been trained in Afghanistan, with evidence suggesting that the group, who operated under the cover of darkness, are responsible for a series of extrajudicial killings and executions across the country, and most worryingly of all, against civilians. Reports from numerous eyewitnesses and survivors suggest that as many as 51 innocent civilians have been killed, with the youngest amongst them being only 8 years old, as the terror group targets schools, medical centers, and other various institutions. With the raids apparently taking place across four districts in Afghanistan, and with most of the victims having no links to the Taliban, the question arises as to whether there's some kind of partnership between the CIA-trained operatives and the Taliban. According to multiple reports, the US has broken multiple rules of war, breached human rights, and has failed to deliver on any of the promises it made when it comes to building a secure Afghanistan. This raises the question as to just how the US can genuinely justify their presence in the country with so many operational failures in place.
The problem, we're talking about the US presence in Afghanistan and what we call in this country collateral damage, is that there is no justification at this point after 18 years. We invaded Afghanistan allegedly to go after the Osama bin Laden, who it turns out was probably hiding in Pakistan. There was no way the Afghanistani government could accede to the demands that President Bush made when he made them in 2001. And, you know, so the justification is just not there. Now, after 18 years...
With attacks such as those completed by the 01 unit, one official from the Afghan intelligence agency has stated that Americans have always been present during the 01 raids. But the official failed to distinguish between the blurred lines as to whether the unit were special forces, task forces, or quite simply, CIA agents. What's clear is that the US has a very shadowy modus operandi, and this is something that seems to allow them to get away with the murder of civilians in the process. With pressure mounting on the US to leave Afghanistan and Iraq, could training such groups by the CIA and US forces guarantee a proxy unit for the US military in the area once they've left? We know from the past that the CIA has a long history of interfering in various sovereign states, and in particular are keen to arm certain groups to the teeth in order to either justify their presence in an area or quite simply allow splinter groups to carry out the dirty work on behalf of Washington and Langley. In fact, when one looks into the money involved in performing such tasks, the figures are quite boggling, with the CIA allocating some $2.5 billion of their budget to covert operations alone, a sum that equates to around 5% of the total intelligence purse. But when some of the groups backed by the CIA are actually fighting back against the US, including killing its military personnel in the area, does this not create a notion of double jeopardy for the US, showing just how desperate they are when it comes to maintaining a foothold in places such as Afghanistan?
Of desperation. The Trump administration met with the Taliban about a year ago or 2 years ago, as far as we can tell, and basically said, if you stop killing Americans, then we can get out of here, basically. We don't care who else you're killing, but don't kill us. And we can work something out, but if you're killing us and killing our troops, then we're never going to be able to withdraw from here, because we're not going to withdraw under fire. That's basically the United States position.
There may be many similar cases around the world that have yet to come to light. This report, however, has finally exposed the CIA as the main funding party behind the execution of civilians. What remains to be seen is whether such groups will remain US proxies in the future and continue to allow the US to carry out a series of illegal operations, all whilst being able to deny being present at the time.
Mujahideen Khalq Organization, MKO, also known as the MEK, is a notorious anti-Iran terror group that embraces an ideology that mixes Marxism and terrorism. MKO's crimes against Iran run the gamut from collaborating with Iraq's former dictator Saddam Hussein during the 1980 to 1988 war on Iran to a violent campaign of bombings across the country. One of the group's highest profile acts of terror came on June 20th, 1981, when a powerful bomb went off at the headquarters of an Iranian political party, the Islamic Republican Party, where the party's leaders were holding a meeting. The bombing killed scores of Iranian officials, including the then head of Supreme Judicial Council, Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti. Iran's army chief, Major General Mousavi, said there were traces of MKO involvement in the assassination of Iran's top scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh last month. The anti-Iran organization has long been recognized as a terror group by much of the international community. However, in June 2008, the United Kingdom crossed the group off its terror list. The move was followed by the European Union in 2009 and the United States in 2012. Canada followed in the footsteps of the Western countries in delisting MKO as a terror group in December 2012 without offering any reason for the decision.
There's no coincidence, because the conservative administration was in power at that time with the prime minister as Stephen Harper, and he was a pro-Zionist, pro-American type of politician. So whatever the Zionist lobbies wanted in Canada, he would work to implement that. Unfortunately, that the West has this double standard and hypocrisy, that they use these groups to their benefit when they feel bankrupt.
Since removing its decade-long ban on the MKO, the Western nations, especially the United States, have used the group as a tool to pressure Iran. In September 2012, then US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said Washington was expunging the MKO from its list of designated terror organizations. The decision came after intense lobbying backed by prominent US officials that included James Woolsey and Porter J. Goss, former CIA directors, Louis J. Free, the former FBI director, President George W. Bush's Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge, and Attorney General Michael Mukasey, and President Obama's first National Security Advisor, General James Jones. Many of the US officials had been paid between $15,000 to $30,000 to deliver speeches to the group, as well as travel expenses to attend lavish rallies in Paris. Former Governor of Pennsylvania, Edward Rendell, said in 2012 that he had been paid a total of $150,000 to $160,000. In 2016 and 2017, Saudi Arabia's former spy chief, Prince Turki bin Faisal Al Saud, attended MKO meetings in Paris. Advanced with God's blessings, bin Faisal said in a speech in the 2016 meeting, wishing the terrorists success in attempting, quote, regime change in Iran.
But this is hypocrisy, because even the governments that come, I mean, the officials from different systems, such as the Saudi regime, you know, last year, you know, a popular person from the Saudi regime came and said that he was in support of changing the system in Iran and bringing democracy, where we already know that Saudi Arabia is the furthest country from democracy. So how could somebody be supporting democracy when his own system itself is far away from democracy?
In 2018, another meeting in Paris attracted Rudy Giuliani, personal attorney to U.S. President Donald Trump, and Stephen Harper, a former Prime Minister of Canada. Pulitzer Prize winner Seymour Hersh reported in 2012 that a number of MKO members were secretly trained by the United States Joint Special Operations Command at the Department of Energy's Nevada National Security Site, a secretive training facility northwest of Las Vegas. The report was followed by another revelation in 2018 that the terrorists were receiving funds through Saudi smuggling networks and Saudi-linked black market sales to continue their subversive agenda. But what does this say about MKO supporters, except that they have become so desperate in their subversive attempts in Iran that they have turned to a cult group they once blacklisted as a terror organization?
The number of Americans seeking unemployment benefits continues to surge at unprecedented levels. Just last week, another 885,000 people filed for first-time unemployment. This is the highest level in the past 3 months. Since the start of the pandemic, more people have lost their jobs and incomes and have become dependent on assistance. Overall, about 20.65 million people are receiving unemployment benefits of some kind since the coronavirus pandemic started in the U.S. The loss of income made millions of American families food insecure. Throughout the pandemic, food banks and pantries have provided millions of Americans with much-needed food. Although hunger is not new in America, the pandemic has had a major impact. Food insecurity has become a widespread national issue, sparing not even some of the wealthier regions. A recent survey shows that 1 in 8 Americans reported that they sometimes, or often, did not have enough food. Overall, food insecurity has doubled since last year, reaching the highest level since 1998. Before the pandemic, the majority of the food bank's clients were the elderly and the underemployed. But there's been a recent influx of service workers who have been disproportionately hit by the COVID-19 crisis. Food insecurity rates spiked at the end of March, when pandemic lockdowns made the U.S. economy stumble. People from Alaska to Georgia are turning to food distribution centers to pick up free groceries. Activists say that food banks are under extra pressure ahead of the upcoming holidays, as requests have skyrocketed. They say that millions of Americans are barely making ends meet and need help to feed their families. Moreover, data by the U.S. Census Bureau indicate that more Americans are going hungry than at any point during the COVID-19 pandemic. The overall U.S. unemployment rate is currently 6.7%, which, while better than previous months, still means that 10 million pre-pandemic jobs have been lost. Economists have said that the jobs that have not returned by this point will be the hardest to claw back, because they're concentrated in the industries most affected by virus containment measures, like leisure, travel, and hospitality. This means that employment gains that people saw during Trump's presidency may not continue at the same pace under Biden. That is because prolonged unemployment, especially in a weak labor market, can be harder to fix. Analysts say that people who have been unemployed for 6 months or more are about twice as likely to drop out of the labor force as to find employment. Moreover, the longer a person is out of work, the less consumer purchasing they do, which further slows economic growth. Data shows that long-term unemployment as a share of unemployment is growing fast across America. In October, 3.6 million of the 11 million unemployed Americans had been out of work for 6 months or longer. That is a ratio not seen since mid-2014, when Biden was the country's vice president. The continuing unemployment crisis has led economists to become increasingly pessimistic about when the country might return to pre-pandemic levels. Business and academic economists surveyed by the Wall Street Journal in April predicted the labor market would recover by the year 2022. But when surveyed again in October, 55% had extended their recovery forecast to the year 2023 or later. In the meantime, there are those who believe the mass vaccination can make real change, but it could be months until the jabs are widely distributed.
Until a certain proportion within the population is not immunized, the impact of the vaccine cannot be visible. For instance, we have to vaccinate at least 70 out of 100 people to achieve the herd immunity. At that point, we will start seeing the benefit of the vaccine in breaking the transmission. Although the U.S. has urged to have 100 million doses in the first quarter of 2021, but even if that is started, what we're looking at is that August, September would be the time when we will have the herd immunity in the United States. At that point, we will start seeing positive impact on. But before that, it is unfortunate, very grim situation.
As the world advances in its technological capabilities, so too then does the way in which various countries across the world need to protect its assets, particularly when it comes to data, information, and national security through the medium of computer-based hosts. The US has recently stated that it's become victim to yet another highly sophisticated cyber attack on its infrastructure, in particular with the attack aimed at multiple ministries across the US government. And more worryingly for the US, it seems that although discovered, the attack is still ongoing. Some of the departments have come out and announced that their systems have been breached at the Departments of Energy, the Treasury, and the Department of Commerce. At this stage, it's not clear which other departments have been hacked into, although there are reports that the National Nuclear Security Administration, which maintains the country's nuclear stockpile, has also been broken into. The US authorities have yet to admit that other more sensitive departments have also been targeted. The hacking appears to have started in March, targeting the Texas-based network security firm SolarWinds via their so-called Orion software, which was incidentally used by a host of US federal agencies and departments. It's unknown at this point as to just how serious the breaches have been, how much information has been obtained by the hackers, or what kind of information has been taken. But what is known is that some 18,000 people have uploaded the SolarWinds Orion update, loaded with the software, allowing the hackers in via the back door, a highly embarrassing situation for the US government. So does this incident suggest that the US is lagging behind in their capability when it comes to preventing such hacks? For a start, the US Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, or CISA, has suffered a huge blow to their reputation, raising the speculation as to whether the US are becoming weaker or whether the hackers are simply getting smarter.
I think it's the latter. I think the hacking abilities have improved. And there's been a proliferation of a lot of private hacking entities, companies, corporations, et cetera, which have proved quite adept when it comes to penetrating the most tightly guarded software facilities.
The priority for the US will now involve securing their cyberspace infrastructure and making sure that the damage done does not cost them too dearly. With more and more states becoming ever more aware and capable when it comes to cyber warfare, the US now have to contemplate who the authors of the cyber attack were and why they targeted the US in the way they did. After all, the US have a host of adversaries around the world. In typical fashion, the Americans have already pointed their fingers towards Moscow as the perpetrators of the attack, claiming that the technology can only have come from a sophisticated source, backed by a state. However, the Russians have nonsensed the US claims, stating they do not participate in such acts. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov has been quoted as stating that the US should not put the blame of their own failures on Russia, claiming that Russia will not stand by and be blamed for anything and everything the US decides it needs a scapegoat for. With Russia being blamed then, could the future of warfare between sovereign states turn to cyber-based attacks and hence see an elevation in frequency and sophistication in the near future?
Yeah, this is a big problem. I mean, attribution is very difficult. It's very difficult to figure out who was behind these attacks. And that's a big problem, because if there's a major disruption, a major attack in the US, and say, you know, power grids go out or emergency services are cut off or whatever, there'll be enormous pressure to retaliate. And therefore, the US could respond in kind to Russia, only to discover months later that it really wasn't Russia at all.
With the White House and Donald Trump remaining eerily silent so far, the US President-elect Joe Biden has come forward, stating that significant funds will be generated during his presidency to disrupt and deter adversaries in targeting the US through cyber attacks. With cyber warfare fast becoming the new norm in global security issues, it seems that across the world, states need to both prepare themselves for cyber attacks and use the technique to secure an advantage over others, as fifth-generation warfare fast becomes a new tool of the state. But more worryingly for all is the notion that individuals and lone actors are also capable and in fact more dangerous when it comes to security breaches in national security through the medium of cyber attacks. So next time you're on your computer, be careful. You have been warned.
Rabbi English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to Rabbi English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Rabbi English Radio.
The limelight.
President-elect Joseph R. Biden Jr. accused President Trump on Tuesday of irrational downplaying of the widespread hack of the federal government and American industries, saying the current administration was denying him intelligence and warning Russia that he would not allow the intrusion to go unanswered after he takes office. This assault happened on Donald Trump's watch when he wasn't watching, Joe Biden said on Tuesday, 22nd of December, at a news conference in Wilmington, Delaware. It is still his responsibility as president to defend American interests for the next 4 weeks. But rest assured that even if he does not take it seriously, I will. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times columnist David Sanger and Nicole Perlroth. The piece is titled, Biden Assails Trump Over Handling of Russia Hacking. President-elect Joe Biden accused President Donald Trump on Tuesday of irrational downplaying of the widespread hack of the federal government and American industries, saying the current administration was denying him intelligence and warning Russia that he would not allow the intrusion to go unanswered after he takes office. This assault happened on Donald Trump's watch when he wasn't watching, Joe Biden said on Tuesday, 22nd of December, at a news conference in Wilmington, Delaware. It is still his responsibility as president to defend American interests for the next 4 weeks, but rest assured that even if he does not take it seriously, I will. The direct critique was a remarkable departure from tradition, in which incoming presidents are careful about not second-guessing the actions of the incumbent. But President Trump's refusal to recognize Joe Biden's election victory and his effort to subvert the results has clearly poisoned elements of the transition process. In recent days, Mr. Biden's aides have come to realize that the scope of the cyber attack, which landed the Russians inside the email system used by top Treasury officials and gave them access to the networks of the Energy, Commerce, and Homeland Security departments and dozens of American companies, could pose a threat in the first days of the new administration. Joe Biden indirectly acknowledged as much when asked about his statement that he could not ensure that government systems could be trusted when he takes office. "Of course I can't," he said. "I don't know what the state of them is. They're clearly not safe right now." Privately, members of his staff have said that whilst they received briefings on the subject, they had been minimal. And the shutdown of recent cooperation between the transition team and the Defense Department has encompassed the National Security Agency and the United States Cyber Command. The quasi-civilian and military sides of the nation foreign offensive and defensive operations. "There's still so much we don't know, including the full scale of the breach or the extent of the damage it has caused," Mr. Biden said. He was alluding to the quiet internal warnings that Russia may have been able to place so-called backdoors in government systems and, in the worst case, manipulate data or sabotage systems. "Was carried out by using sophisticated cyber tools, and the attacker succeeded in catching the federal government off guard and unprepared," Mr. Biden said. Unlike Mr. Trump, the president-elect left no doubt that he believed Russia was responsible, noting that both Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Attorney General William Barr had said as much publicly, even if Donald Trump would not. And Mr. Biden said once there was a formal determination of responsibility, a task that could take intelligence agencies weeks, "We will respond and probably respond in kind." That vow is likely to prove easier to issue from the stage in Delaware than it will be to execute from the Situation Room. Joe Biden's first encounter with President Vladimir Putin of Russia will be on another topic. The two men will have 16 days to negotiate an extension of up to 5 years of New START, the nuclear arms control treaty that expires in early February. That will force Mr. Biden to strike a deal to prevent one threat, a nuclear arms race, while simultaneously threatening retaliation on another. Moreover, while the United States is awash in digital targets, Russia is a far less connected society, making an in-kind response more difficult. And it is hardly a state secret that the United States already spies on Russian systems and has turned off computers at the Internet Research Agency, the Kremlin-backed disinformation group that has involved in election interference in 2016. The New York Times reported last year that the United States had implanted malware into Russia's electric power grid as a warning to Moscow that the discovery that Russia had done the same to the American national power grid. Of course, the U.S. intelligence community does these every day and twice on Sundays, said Dmitry Alperovich, the chairman of the think tank Silverado Policy Accelerator and the former chief technology officer of the cybersecurity firm CrowdStrike, where he specialized in Russian cyber operations. Dmitry Alperovich added, "We have all used supply chain attacks and we can't say it's okay for us and not for others," he said on Deep State Radio, a podcast. In fact, the Russians often cite such operations to argue that American outrage over espionage and even more extensive cyber attacks is manufactured. Joe Biden said that the United States should be getting together with our allies to try to set up an international system that will constitute appropriate behavior in cyberspace and hold any other country liable for breaking out of those basic rules. Those efforts are hardly new. President Barack Obama tried a basic agreement with President Xi Jinping of China late in his term in office after the Chinese were caught removing 22.5 million security clearance files from the Office of Personnel Management, another hacking that went largely undetected for a year. The accord quickly fell apart after Barack Obama left office. But the more immediate problem for President-elect Joe Biden may be finding and securing vulnerable elements of the software supply chain that Russia exploited when it bought into network management software made by SolarWinds, an Austin, Texas company, and corrupted its updates with malware. That is one of several ways Russia is believed to have entered such an array of agencies and corporations. During the investigation into the Russian hacking, the Department of Homeland Security's Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency released a report based on a two-year, still unfinished review of the risks to the United States of a supply chain attack. The report concluded that supply chain risks could have far-reaching and potentially devastating impacts. An understatement, as the government feverishly digs through its systems for evidence of Russian compromise.
Around the World with Reporters.
Pakistan had a fresh round of negotiations with the UAE in an effort to repair lingering strained relations between the two countries. Pakistan has been under pressure from the UAE to normalize ties with the apartheid state of Israel since August this year, when Abu Dhabi recognized Tel Aviv. For the first time, Islamabad publicly admitted about the existence of a lingering UAE demand to Pakistan to grant diplomatic recognition to Israel, something which Islamabad rejected after the country's foreign minister's visit to Abu Dhabi.
I have abundantly made it clear to the UAE that Pakistan under no circumstances can establish diplomatic ties with Israel until a permanent and durable solution is found to the Palestinian issue. I have told them about anti-Israeli public sentiments in Pakistan and reminded them of the similar nature of dispute between Kashmir and Palestine.
Foreign Minister's visit to Abu Dhabi has followed suspension of visas to Pakistani citizens after alleged behind-the-scenes threats to Islamabad to replace its 1.5 million expatriates if Pakistan resisted pressure to normalize ties with Tel Aviv.
Pakistan made its position clear because of the mounting pressure from some of the Islamic countries. The problem for Pakistan is that at the public level, at the people level, it is very difficult to sell this idea of giving recognition to Israel, because for decades, Pakistani people have been steadfastly supporting the cause of the Palestinian people.
Despite close brother relations with the UAE, tens of thousands of people protested against Abu Dhabi after it normalized ties with Tel Aviv. Israel has been desperate to normalize ties with Pakistan, hoping that if it happens, other Islamic countries would also follow the suit. However, observers say that Israel's effort through UAE and Saudi Arabia to create compelling conditions against Pakistan to normalize ties have fallen flat. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
The United Nations Security Council has held a virtual meeting to review the 10th report into the implementation of Resolution 2231, which endorses the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. During the session on Tuesday, Iran's permanent representative to the UN slammed the United States for not only failing to honor its own obligations under the resolution, but also obstructing the implementation of the commitments by other signatories. Takravanchi explained that in the past 4 years, the U.S. has imposed over 1,500 sanctions against Iran, targeting almost all sectors of Tehran's economy and cutting nearly all dividends from the nuclear agreement for Iran. He also referred to the humanitarian impacts of the sanctions on Iran, saying the embargoes are affecting the most vulnerable people in the country.
The United States claim that humanitarian goods are exempt from sanctions is an absolute lie. As an example, even today, we cannot easily import medicine for relieving the breathing problems of those injured by chemical weapons, which were provided by some Western countries to Saddam and used by him during his aggression against Iran.
The Iranian ambassador reiterated Tehran's stance that any proposal for the revision, renegotiation, or extension of the JCPOA is against the UN Resolution 2231 and absolutely unacceptable.
Iran has paid a heavy price and has done much more than its fair share to preserve the JCPOA. Therefore, no one can expect us to do more.
Takravanchi further said that the deal cannot be linked to anything outside of the nuclear program, such as Iran's missile capabilities.
To develop a conventional missile program is an inherent right of any country under international law, and Iran is no exception. Consequently, Iran will not negotiate its legitimate ballistic missile program.
The Security Council session came a day after the foreign ministers of the remaining signatories to the JCPOA held a virtual meeting and reiterated their commitments to preserving the agreement. China and Russia in particular call on the U.S. to unconditionally return to the deal and lift its unilateral sanctions against Iran. This comes more than 3 weeks after the Iranian parliament passed a bill that requires the Iranian government to suspend more commitments under the nuclear deal in case sanctions continue. Iran started scaling back some of its commitments a year after the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the deal. Tehran has time and again rejected any preconditions for reviving the agreement, noting that they will go back to full compliance once all the other parties to the court uphold their own end of the deal.
All flights and trains coming from the United Kingdom have been barred from entering Europe. Other countries, including Canada, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Colombia, and Morocco, have also suspended flights to and from the UK for 48 hours or more. Britons have been rattled by the Prime Minister's announcement that Christmas visits will have to be cancelled because of the new COVID-19 strain. And now there are growing fears the country will run out of fresh food in the days before Christmas because of freight and transport disruption. The government insists there's nothing to be worried about, though, and that ahead of Brexit, the government is fully prepared.
It's vital first to stress that these delays, which are only occurring at Dover, only affect human-handled freight, and that is only 20% of the total arriving from or departing to the European continent, which means the vast majority of food, medicines, and other supplies are coming and going as normal.
The British government is dealing with an escalating public health crisis, deepening economic upheaval, and Brexit trade talks in Brussels simultaneously. Prime Minister Boris Johnson's handling of all three crises has come under fire, and faith in the government is waning.
It's just got to a point where now people are just going to feel like their freedom is being restricted and their basic sort of human rights, and it's spending millions of pounds on an app that doesn't even work. So, I mean, yeah, making promises they can't adhere to. So I think, yeah, they've really shot themselves in the foot.
They're doing an okay job. I think obviously they could probably do better, but, you know, I think it's always easy when you're looking on the outside in, going, you know, we'd do this or that.
No more promises that we'll be over this by such and such a day at a time now. I mean, it's a difficult situation for the government, but no more promises. We'll be over this by Christmas, Easter, a day at a time. It's debatable. And who would want to be in the government situation at the moment? It's changing by the day worldwide.
I think, you know, you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. I would... urge people to think about, you know, what would they have done if they had been faced with everything that has happened, because I don't necessarily think that there's one right course of action. I don't necessarily think that our government have handled it the perfect way, but what is the perfect way kind of thing? And I don't think people have helped themselves by rebelling against the rules and all of that kind of thing. So
people are going to complain no matter what Boris Johnson says or does, so...
The new strain of COVID-19 has already been detected in the Netherlands, Denmark, Belgium, and Iceland. On the upside, the scientists are saying the new strain is not resistant to the vaccines now being approved and administered. More than 500,000 people have received the Pfizer jab in the UK, which was the first country to approve it, and Europe's medicine regulators have approved it as well, which means inoculations will be underway across the bloc in a matter of days. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Yemen scholars came together in the capital Sana'a to condemn some Arab states for normalizing ties with the Israeli regime. They said that with signing normalization deals with Israel, these states have betrayed the Palestinians.
We've announced the continuous processes of normalization of ties with the Zionist entity. We are here to warn other Arab states not to follow the same path. Any normalization deal amounts to the betrayal of the blood of the martyrs who sacrificed their lives to protect the occupied lands against Israeli aggression.
Morocco has been the last Arab state to normalize ties with Israel after Bahrain, the UAE, and Sudan over the past months.
The scholars of Yemen reiterate their opposition to any recognition of the Zionist enemy. We believe that it amounts to betrayal of the Muslim values. This will pave the way for further aggression against the Palestinians.
The normalization deals have already sparked outrage among the public in the Muslim world, with pro-Palestine sentiment runs deep. Meanwhile, Palestinians from all political factions have been unanimous in their condemnation of the normalization deals. They seek an independent state in the West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip with the East Jerusalem Al-Quds as its capital. So the normalization, they say, serves as betrayal of their cause.
Yemeni scholars voiced their support for the Palestinians, warning Arab world to adopt a united stance against Israeli aggression. They say the normalization deals will only embolden Israel to press ahead with its oppressive policies against the Palestinians. Abdul Latif Al Washali, Sana'a.
The news was delivered Saturday that the southeast and east of England, including the capital London, were descending into Tier 4 COVID-19 restrictions. This was sparked by the discovery of a new variant of the virus that is up to 70% more transmittable.
Given the early evidence we have on this new variant of the virus, the potential risk it poses, it is with a very heavy heart, I must tell you, we cannot continue with